But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to become an adulteress. And anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbours and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect.
The Sermon on the Mount that completely misses the point that Jesus was making. And I guess it's a way that both Christians and those who wouldn't yet call ourselves Christians use it as a kind of stick to beat people over the head with, so that our reading of it becomes more like a kind of finger-wagging exercise as we waggle on the tee. Well, this evening we're going to see that that kind of reading of the Sermon on the Mount is precisely the opposite to what Jesus intended as he taught. So if you turn to page 969, to Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 to 48... we're going to look at the passage that was read to us earlier. Now, if you were with us here last week, you'll remember that we were looking at verse 17. And if you allow me to read it, do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets, says Jesus. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And we learned last week as we were studying that verse and being taught that verse, that Jesus fills full the Old Testament. Then we went on and had a look at verse 20. Let's read that as well. For I tell you, says Jesus, that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So that second verse suggests that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, highly respected people around at the time, had a kind of righteousness, but that their righteousness was phony. There was something dodgy about it. It didn't quite tie in with the law and the prophets that Jesus says he's going to fulfill. So as we study chapter 5, what I want us to do is to think about two questions. First, how does what Jesus is saying in our verses fulfill the Old Testament? And secondly, what does real righteousness look like? Those are the two questions we were left with at the end of last week. And that brings us to our first point. Jesus fulfills the law and the prophets, the Old Testament, because he demands his Father's features. And the point under this heading is this. At the head of God's heavenly kingdom is a loving heavenly Father. Given that the heavenly Father is at the head of the family, family likeness is an essential criterion for and indication of family membership. You get that? Family likeness is an essential criterion for and indication of family membership. Now, in our passage, Jesus takes six examples of the kind of purity that he says is needed and expected from members of his kingdom. But the six examples are illustrations of the main point that he demands the Father's features. And the main point is there in verse 20. Let's read it again. I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, it's easy to treat the Pharisees as kind of spiritual baddies. The church I went to once ran a holiday club. It was a fine holiday club, and I think it was called Spies, something like that. Anyway, every time the Pharisees came on stage dressed in black, all the children were instructed firmly to hiss and boo. And I expect numbers of them have been involved in that holiday club with the children before. But the real situation in the first century wasn't nearly as clear-cut as that. When it came to moral purity, the Pharisees appeared to have it sussed. They didn't seem to be baddies at all. They were the main set of people who were deeply conscious about and concerned about keeping God's law. Ahead of everybody else in their society, they were the ones who were intent on proving themselves to be genuine sons of God. In fact, they were so concerned, these Pharisees, to keep God's law, that they had written a further 613 laws, 248 positive ones and 365 negative ones, which interpreted God's law in the Ten Commandments in practical, daily ways of living to hedge it around and to make absolutely certain that they didn't break it. So you see, verse 20, the Pharisees clearly had a righteousness of a kind. If you looked at them, you'd say for sure that they looked morally righteous. But, says Jesus in verse 20, if his disciples want to be members of God's heavenly kingdom, they need something that far exceeds the righteousness of those law-abiding Pharisees. And the point is made at the other end of our passage in verse 48. Right at the end there, as Jesus sums up the points he'd been making. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Do you see the point? He demands the Father's features. True membership of God's heavenly family requires a family likeness that goes far deeper than just the surface mask of law-keeping that the Pharisees had got in place. It requires something that goes down to heart likeness to the Father. And just in case we're not convinced about the seriousness of this point and the point that Jesus is making, he really drums it home in the six examples by including a number of very serious warnings. And I want us just to look at this to realize quite how serious Jesus is. Look at verse 22 and the first part of it. I tell you that anybody who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Look at the next verse. Anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. Anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Then look at verse 29 and 30. You've heard that it was said, don't commit adultery. I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery within her in her heart. Verse 27 and 28, 29. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Then look at verse 30. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. In other words, this is serious stuff, says Jesus. The issues at stake here are eternity. There are two destinies being spoken about. They are both quite clear. One is membership of God's Heavenly Father, with God the Father at the head of that kingdom, living in a loving relationship with Him forever. The other is judgment, condemnation, and the eternal fire of hell, which Jesus means is forever. Now I can imagine somebody sitting there and saying, just hold on a minute, William, aren't you slightly being a touch melodramatic? I mean, this is the Sermon on the Mount. This is Jesus' most famous teaching, the kind of thing you can sit about at the golf course and talk about. This is gentle Jesus, meek and mild on the mountainside in sunny Palestine where I go for my holidays. Less of this black and white absolutist hellfire stuff. But if that is the kind of impression you get just from those first opening few moments, I want to encourage you to read the Sermon on the Mount. Because all the way through the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is presenting us with these two possible destinies. And he's saying we go one way or the other. Just look at chapter 7, verse 13, on the say just over the page, the bottom of page 971. Enter through the narrow gate, he says, still in the Sermon on the Mount, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter it. Look at verse 21. Not everyone, says Jesus, who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, didn't we prophesy and so on? And then verse 23, I will tell them plainly, I never knew you, away from me. Look at verse 27 of chapter 7. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against the house, it fell with a great crash. So I hope you see, and do talk to me about this afterwards, but I hope you see that we have to talk in absolutist, clear, black and white terms when we're dealing with this issue, because that is the way Jesus talks in the Sermon on the Mount. He's not just giving a kind of quiet fireside chat on the state of the British economy or RE in our schools. It's not just a simple tabloid discussion on the relative merits of the spin of Shane Warne or the poetic and dramatic abilities of Eric the King. What he is laying before us here are the facts and figures of eternity. That's why the Sermon on the Mount is such a staggering piece of teaching. And there is a huge amount at stake. Either it is family membership or it is weeping and gnashing of teeth in regret and remorse at missed opportunities. And his message is this: if you're going to enter the Father's kingdom, then the surface law-keeping and box-ticking that the Pharisees were engaging is simply not enough to indicate that you are members of it. There needs to be something that goes far deeper than that. The Father's features need to be written into your hearts, your thinking, your motives, your lifestyle. There needs to be genuine evidence of genuine family likeness. And again, I want you to see that there is nothing new about all this. Last week we saw that Jesus fulfills the law and the prophets in his teaching. The law and the prophets have always taught this. Leviticus chapter 19. Be holy, says God, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. He demands the Father's features. And just to make sure that we get the point, Jesus then takes these six examples through our passage, where it seems that the Pharisees were taking hold of the law, looking at the surface value, ticking the boxes, and therefore claiming to be children of their Heavenly Father. And in each case, Jesus reinterprets the law for them to show them that they had completely missed the point. Let's just take one case. We're not going to go through all six of them. Let's just take one case in verses 21 and 22 of chapter 5. You have heard that it was said, says Jesus, to the people long ago, do not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raka, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. Anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Janet, my wife, and I got out the video In the Name of the Father. It is a fascinating account of the trial and subsequent retrial of the Guildford Four, who allegedly blew up the pub in Guildford. You can't help coming out of that film, if you've seen it, with a deep sense of uncertainty. Whatever you thought before about the trial and retrial, or about the Guildford Four, and whether they were innocent or not, the film leaves you deeply uncertain. See, as we come to the Sermon on the Mount, there is no uncertainty at all. Jesus can't be clearer as he expounds his Father's character. Innocence from murder, he says, isn't simply a matter of not having blood on your hands. The Pharisees who have hedged the law around with their 613 achievable do's and don'ts can't look on and say, oh, well, we've never been involved in that, you know. Murder, says Jesus, begins with a thought harbored in the heart. It begins with someone somewhere saying to themselves, I hate you. I wish you'd get out of my space. Raka, you imbecile. I remember walking along the road once, along a street once, and there was a guy staring at me. And I was fitter and bigger and healthier in those days. And I said to him, and slightly more pugnacious, what are you looking at? And quick as a flash, he said, not much. And I just passed on. It was too clever. But that is what Raka... Didn't take him round the back. Raka means you imbecile. You blockhead. You waster. You fool. Murder begins with contempt, envy, anger. And the Heavenly Father, who is head of the heavenly family, isn't conned by the fact that you and I don't have blood on our hands when our hearts are dripping with guilt. You know, which of our students hasn't secretly looked across at some other group of students or a lecturer or a guy across the corridor who's music booms out and shakes the foundations of the hall and thinks and hasn't thought, Raka. Which of us office workers hasn't gone home of an evening seething with contempt for a boss or sat in the pub mocking the headmaster for his daft decision? Raka, you fool. My mother told me of a friend of hers who put her daughter-in-law on the bus to Heathrow Airport the other day, and her passing words were to her daughter-in-law, you are a lazy slut, what a relief, you're going to America. Now that, I thought, was a good way of dealing with your daughter-in-law, any potential mother-in-laws. But which of us family members hasn't at some stage stormed out of a room, slammed the door in anger, hurled abuse at a father or mother or brother or sister? Raka! Now, do you see Jesus' point? He takes the law and with supreme authority he reinterprets it. A mask of shallow sincerity simply isn't deep enough. And he says, verses 21 to 26, there is to be no hatred in your heart. Verse 27 to 30, there is to be no lust in your looks. Verses 31 to 32, there is to be no allowance for your adultery. verses 33 to 37, there are to be no lies on your lips. 38 to 42, there is to be no resting on your rights. 43 to 47, there is to be no limit to your loving. He demands the Father's features. At the head of the heavenly kingdom is a heavenly Father who is perfect. And he says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees, you have not shown yourself to be a member of that kingdom. Surface righteousness alone isn't what the Father is after. That's not what makes us members of God's heavenly kingdom or demonstrates that we're in. I wonder what you make of the Sermon on the Mount then. It's easy, isn't it, to take it and treat it in quite the opposite way to what it's intended. How easy to take it and beat somebody over the head with it. If only they'd pull their socks up. If only they'd live a slightly decent life and bring their behaviour into the general bounds of decency, well then we'd get on slightly better in this planet. Now that is absolutely not what the Sermon on the Mount is about. It's about whether you or I belong to God's heavenly kingdom. The stakes are high. It's about heaven and hell. It's about eternity with a loving Father or eternity weeping and gnashing in regret and disappointment. And Jesus says, unless your righteousness overflows that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you certainly won't be part of that heavenly kingdom. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. He demands the Father's features. Now that then brings us to the second point, and the point is this: Jesus fulfills the law and the prophets because Jesus, in his teaching, exposes a fatal flaw. He demands the Father's features. He exposes a fatal flaw. You see, as Jesus expounds his Father's perfect character and shows his listeners who is at the head of the family, so he exposes the true membership of all his listeners, the true family membership of all his listeners. And you can imagine the shock. Gathered on that mountain in the first century Galilee are Jesus' disciples and a vast sea of a crowd. All through their lives, they've been taught by and looked up to the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the spiritual aristocracy, the jet set of the religious scene. But as Jesus expounds his Father's character, it becomes all too apparent that for all their external exactness, they are illegitimate. They may be able to recite the creed. They may have come from the keenest of keen religious backgrounds. They may be able to look across at the moral imperfections of the rest of society and tut and mutter. But one thing these Pharisees cannot do is call themselves sons of their heavenly Father. I don't know if you've come across that DNA fingerprinting technique that enables scientists to trace people's family lines and apparently solved any number of disputes. This week there were several columns in the Times devoted to a recent scientific breakthrough, and apparently after 30 years of continuous and careful observation and reporting, scientists had concluded that a particular group of chimpanzees in the Tay Forest of the Ivory Coast were monogamous and faithful within their social group. And they obviously, punters from California University, been out there studying them through their telescopes and all the rest of it for years and years. Two guys have just gone out there and done some DNA surveys and found that 50% of the babies were fathered by male chimps from outside of the colony, thus blowing the whole sort of research of 30 years out of the water. Yet another vital breakthrough in the history of the human race. It is remarkable what the Californian government spends its money on. You see, that all looked fine and hunky-dory on the outside. The scientists, though, were staggered. They were staggered initially by the remarkable faithfulness and the steady relationships. But when the DNA fingerprinting was done, well, things that were going on under the surface were revealed. The truth was laid bare. And as Jesus expounds the Father's features, so what is going on below the surface is revealed. the natural and the true parentage of his listeners is laid bare. The Pharisees are not sons of their heavenly Father. They'd kept up the pretense for years. They'd fooled everybody, but not Jesus. They have no heart concern for pleasing the Father, no real relationship, no deep desire. So as we go back through the passage again and look at each of the sections, we find that the result of the Sermon on the Mount, the fingerprinting, rings out clearly. There is hatred in their hearts, but their Father in heaven hates murder. There is lust in their looks, but their Father in heaven hates adultery. They have made allowance for adultery, but their Father in heaven hates divorce. There are lies on their lips, but their Father in heaven loves truth. They have been resting on their rights. The Father in heaven is prepared to give up his rights for the sake of others. They have limited their loving, but the Father in heaven has no limit to his love. And perhaps the place where it becomes most obvious is in verses 43 to 47. So we'll look at those just for a couple of moments. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbour, verse 43, and hate your enemy. Now there is no doubt that the Old Testament tells us to love our neighbours. But it seems that some of the teachers of the law were limiting love to neighbours alone. So in efforts to keep the law, long discussions were being held about who is my neighbour and who isn't. People had concluded that it's okay loving your fellow Israelite, but what about the Roman soldiers who were the occupying forces in God's land? That's a different matter. They were God's enemies. So they shouldn't love them. A policy of resistance and of non-cooperation. Now let's look at 44 to 47. But I tell you, says Jesus, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? If you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Don't even the pagans do that? Now do you see the point? God, the loving Father, rains down his goodness on his friends and his enemies. If we limit our loving just to those whom we consider our friends and refuse to love the person at work who persecutes us or the religious or authorities who seem intent on stopping our work, then what's the difference between us and the pagan world? If we harbour resentment and bitterness and long for opportunities to seek revenge in tit-for-tat guerrilla warfare in the office, then, says Jesus, we are not sons of our Father in heaven. Now, do you see what is happening as Jesus expounds his Father's character? The true family membership and family likeness of his listeners is being exposed. The fatal flaw is being laid bare. And in that sense, once again, Jesus is fulfilling the law and the prophets. See, Paul puts it like this in Romans, through the law, we become conscious of sin. That is, as God's perfect character is taught and expounded, so it acts like a mirror and shows us what we're really like. Like one of those apples which on the surface looks rosy and red and you bite into and you find that it's rotten and hollow. Like one of those second-hand cars you buy that looks gleaming and perfect with 0 miles on the mileometer. But when you open the bonnet, you see is old and ropey and decrepit. You see, it is possible to get the Sermon on the Mount 100% upside down, like our two friends in the golf club. They were using the Sermon on the Mount in exactly the same way as the Pharisees were using the law. They were using it to pat themselves on the back. Thank goodness that we're not like the riffraff. What a delight that we're not like the underclass. What are we going to do with those teenage delinquents? What a joy that we're not morally impure and compromised. But the whole point of the law and of Jesus' teaching here is to expose the fatal flaw in us as individuals, in us as a group, in us who claim to be members of God's heavenly kingdom. So to use his Sermon on the Mount as a kind of mutual backpacking, patting exercise, or as a club to thrash other people over the head with, completely misses the point. What we should be doing is allowing it to sift us, to measure us, to expose us, to act like a surgeon's knife, cutting through the external performance, laying bare our fatal flaw, showing us what we are truly like on the inside. Jesus' teaching on his Father's character should act like the DNA fingerprint and expose the true origin of our family tree. Who do we really belong to? The Father in heaven? Or are we in danger of the fire of hell? Verse 47, if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Don't even the pagans do that? And that brings us to our final point. First, Jesus fulfills the law in that he demands the Father's features. Secondly, Jesus fulfills the law in that he reveals the fatal flaw. Thirdly, Jesus fulfills the law in that he drives us back to the family foundations. And the family foundations are explained right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, verse 3 through to 10. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the kingdom. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. You are highly favored by God. We are highly favored by God if we are poor in spirit. That is, if we're not like the Pharisees, puffing ourselves up and inflating our spiritual ego, but rather we recognize that we have a fatal flaw, that on the inside we are not good and simply needing a leg up or a help in the right direction, that on the inside we are rotten. We are highly favored by God if we mourn our spiritual poverty. We are highly favored by God if we are meek before God, recognizing our poverty, falling on our knees to him in dependence. We are highly favored by God if we hunger and thirst for righteousness. So do you see that the whole point of the Sermon on the Mount is to fulfill the law and the prophets by driving us to our knees in open and honest awareness that we fall far short of the Father's perfection. And just to confirm that that is what Matthew wants the Sermon on the Mount to do, turn to chapter 8, verse 3. Chapters 5 to 7 show us the Sermon on the Mount, exposing us for what we're really like. Fatally flawed, unable to meet the Father's features of perfection. Chapter 8, 9 and 10 present Jesus as the one who has come to deal with sin. So 8 verse 3, up comes a leper, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Verse 3, I am willing, be clean. 9 verse 6, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralytic, get up and walk. 9 verse 13. or verse 12 and 13, it is not the healthy, like the Pharisee, who need a doctor, but the sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I have not come to call the righteous, but the sinners. Now, do you see the point? If we have allowed the Sermon on the Mount to drive us back to the family foundation of spiritual poverty, of meekness, of mourning over our sin, of longing for a righteousness that is not the Pharisee's righteousness, then we will breathe a huge sigh of relief when we get to chapters 8, 9 and 10 and find that Jesus has come to deal with our poverty, to make us rich and to give us righteousness. So now in conclusion, the humanistic atheist, the moralizing politician, the self-righteous pagan, yes, they all have a righteousness like that of the Pharisee. Men and women are essentially good, they say. But human beings do need a bit of a helping hand. We need a leg up, a shove in the right direction. We need to pull our socks up. The odd bit of sound advice. RE at school. Moral guidance, perhaps, on the TV. Something like the Sermon on the Mount, you know, or the Five Pillars, or something along those lines. Let's put them on our school curriculum. Some of us Christians have a righteousness like the Pharisee. Oh, we say us Christians are the only decent ones left. If only the rest of our society had a moral purity like us. The Church of England needs a moral crusade, you know. We'll join forces with the humanistic atheists and the moralizing politicians and the self-righteous pagans, and we'll help everybody everywhere to generally pull their socks up. And we might teach them the Sermon on the Mount. That'll help. Jesus says, I fulfill the law and the prophets. My Father's features are perfection. You have a fatal flaw. Whoever you are, however good the moral mask, you have hatred in your heart. You have lust in your looks. You make allowances for your adultery. You have lies on your lips. You rest on your rights, and you limit your loving. We need far more than just pulling our socks up or a moral crusade. The surgery required is much more radical than that. It needs to go right to the heart. We're much more wicked than we realize. And we need to go back to the family foundation. To come to Jesus in utter dependence as the founder of the family. And maybe somebody here who's never ever done that. Well, stop kidding yourself. This is serious stuff. Eternity is at stake. Allow God's teaching to do its work, to expose you for what you're really like, to drive you to Jesus for the forgiveness that he can and will do. Because at the end of the day, the Sermon on the Mount has the same purpose as the law in the Old Testament, to expose us for what we are really like and to drive us to our knees, Christians and those who are not yet Christians alike, and to leave us dependent on him. Well, now I'm going to leave a moment's quiet. You might like to read through perhaps just two of those sections that we've been looking at. To look at the Father's features that are demanded. To realize that we do have this fatal flaw. And then we're going to sing this tremendous song which reminds us that there is a Redeemer as we come back to him in dependence.